loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we have two big stories. First, we continue our weekly series looking at the big economic issues facing society today. Next, we have a fascinating interview with Dr. Alex Vitale, whose latest book, The End of Policing, raises a profoundly different view of the criminal legal system and policing in the United States and what needs to be done to change them. We cover the origins of modern policing, the school-to-prison pipeline, the suppression of gangs, the war on drugs, and the so-called war on terror. This is an amazing interview that comes in our second half hour. Stay with us for that. But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, threatened to take unilateral action against Iran after Russia vetoed a Security Council resolution condemning Iran for supposedly interfering in Yemen. Haley never mentioned U.S., Saudi, and Emirati involvement in the Yemen war or the humanitarian disaster that has taken place since the Saudi invasion. Turning to the Supreme Court, the court today took up a battle between the government and Microsoft over the privacy of its customers' data. The issue is actually very simple. Can the company be compelled to turn over to the government customer emails stored on overseas servers? Shelling and airstrikes continued in Ghouta, Syria yesterday, despite the ceasefire. Meanwhile, the New York Times reported that the United Nations has an unreleased report saying that North Korea is delivering chemical weapons to the Syrian government. We're going to take a look at that story. Hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans are still without power 5 months after Hurricane Maria devastated the island's infrastructure, but that hasn't stopped FEMA from sending repair crews home after being paid for doing almost nothing. And the rapper Akon said today that his offer of philanthropic aid to restore power was actually rejected by Washington. Finally, the Departments of State and Defense have reached a deal to spend $40 million to fight foreign government-sponsored propaganda with the help from the private sector. The State Department's Global Engagement Center, which was set up to counter Islamist propaganda, will now turn its attention to Russia. Those are the stories that we'll cover in our second hour. But John Kiriakou, that's not the only news of the day. What else is going on?
Well, presidential son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner has had his security clearance downgraded, a move that will prevent him from viewing many of the sensitive documents to which he once had unfettered access. The Justice Department unexpectedly stepped into a discrimination case today, saying that discrimination based on sexual orientation is not covered under the Civil Rights Act. As of Monday, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals joined the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, saying that discrimination based on sexual orientation is unconstitutional and covered under the Civil Rights Act. However, the 11th Circuit Appeals Court has ruled against that. Given the divided rulings at the federal appeals level, this issue should be ripe for the U.S. Supreme Court to take up, with the new conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch likely voting against. Another big shakeup in Saudi Arabia has taken place, with de facto ruler Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman firing top military commanders and replacing them with younger commanders. The Crown Prince has been aggressively consolidating power and purging potential rivals as he prepares to take over the throne from his elderly father, King Salman. Saudi Arabia has also invited Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri for an official visit for the first time since the Saudis detained him and forced his resignation last year in what was seen as an unprecedented act of aggression. Prime Minister Hariri accepted the invitation and said the trip would take place as soon as possible. Saleh Muslim, a high-ranking leader of the Syrian Kurdish PYD that controls the northeast of that country, has been released from custody pending trial in the Czech Republic. Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan's government has been pushing Czech authorities to extradite Muslim to Turkey, accusing him of being a terrorist. Georgia Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle on Monday threatened Delta Airlines to reinstate discounts and perks for NRA members and to, quote, fully reinstate its relationship with the NRA, unquote, or he would retaliate by trying to kill legislation that gives airlines massive tax breaks on jet fuel. Cagle is running for governor this year and boasts an A-plus rating from the NRA. In the meantime, Washington, Pittsburgh, and Chicago have all invited Delta Airlines to relocate there. Donald Trump has already announced his campaign manager for his 2020 re-election campaign. That is Brad Parscale. Parscale was Trump's digital strategist in the 2016 race and has since been working at a pro-Trump super PAC. And finally, Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee has decided to stick to his decision of last fall to retire. Strategists note that this may be due to the Trump administration being unwilling to weigh in on the primary race. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series looking at the economic issues of the day. We help try to decipher those issues, make them understandable for all of us, the public. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, a number of big stories to talk about this week. Let's start with the new Federal Reserve chairperson, Jerome Powell. He says the central bank, he's the Trump appointee, can stay its current course of gradual increases in interest rates in light of a positive forecast for economic growth. In his public debut, Powell told the House Financial Services Committee on Tuesday, quote, "Some of the headwinds the U.S. economy faced in previous years have turned into tailwinds. Fiscal policy has become more stimulative and foreign demand for U.S. exports is on a firmer trajectory." Well, if true, that has to be good news for the Trump administration.
Yeah, let me put this in context for people, because I know when you talk about the Fed's kind of meeting minutes, you know, people's eyes might glaze over. What he's talking about is a policy where they'll continue to raise the interest rates, which have been historically low ever since the 2008 financial crisis. So if you look at the papers in the last couple of weeks or month, there was some reports that unemployment rates were very low. And what the general kind of billionaire, millionaire consensus has been is that that number makes them nervous because too many people have jobs, too many people are getting paid, and there's too much money in the economy, which puts us at risk for inflation. So what the Fed chairman is saying is, I'm going to continue to raise interest rates, which is a way of artificially restricting the money supply and to fight off inflation. I think what might be surprising to a lot of people is that, really low employment numbers can actually have a destabilizing effect, or really low unemployment numbers can have a destabilizing effect on the economy, because there's too much cash, there's too much money, and it's simply the law of supply and demand. If there's a glut of oranges, then oranges are cheaper. If there's a glut of money because people are making more money or having more employment, then that also has a destabilizing effect. So what he's saying essentially is, don't worry, billionaires and millionaires, I'll make sure that doesn't happen by artificially restricting money supply. And that's essentially what the minutes are focusing on.
Well, low unemployment also gives an advantage for the one commodity workers have to sell, which would be their ability to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they sell that in the form and get in exchange for the deal with the boss that you get a wage. And in exchange, the boss gets your ability to labor for a certain number of hours each day. Whether you labor well or not well depends on the level of technology and the organization and management features of a company. But workers just, basically they're getting wages for the time they spend on the job. That's what it's all about. If there's a lower number of unemployed people competing for jobs, that also means working workers, the employed, can also demand higher wages from their employer without having to fear looking over their shoulder that this army of the unemployed is ready to take their job at lower wages. How big of an issue is the issue of maybe it would be called wage inflation, but really it's just called decent wages or increasing wages for the employer class?
Yeah, it matters tremendously. A small, as you mentioned, a very low unemployment rate means that people can demand higher wages and that companies will be forced to pay higher wages to attract employees. That has the very wealthy, the kind of 1% worried, because that, of course, cuts into their bottom line and it makes it harder for them to rake in record profits. So especially we've seen this huge financial bubble in the stock market in the last 10 years or so, which has just skyrocketed and exploded. And that's in part because wages have been able to be kept at historically low growth rates. They've been very stagnant. They haven't kept up with the increases in productivity. They haven't been kept up with the profitability of these companies. And that allows these companies to have, you know, insane super profits, which is what we're seeing. Now we're, for the first time in a long time, we're really seeing very low unemployment numbers and they're getting frightened. The part of the Fed's job is to try to rein that back, try to rein that in and say, okay, we'll reduce the money supply to try to even things out. It has a dampening effect. It's not, you know, a panacea, but this has a lot of the extremely wealthy very worried because it is going to cut into their bottom line.
Daniel, I have a question about inflation again. You know, we hear so much about inflation and virtually every time the Fed comes out with a statement or the Fed, any of the Fed governors give a speech, it's about inflation. But we haven't really had inflation in many years. So what exactly, what level of inflation is supposed to be an unacceptable level? Isn't inflation, at least a little bit of inflation, a good thing?
Yeah, exactly. A little bit of inflation is a good thing. And the Fed's job is to keep that rate gradually moving up, but not skyrocketing. You know, different people argue about the number. You know, there was a report by Goldman Sachs which said that if the interest rate the Treasury was setting hit 4.5 or higher, that there would be a huge crash in the stock market, that there'd be a huge reduction in equity prices, which is possible. But, you know, we really, like you said, John, haven't seen anything like that since probably the 70s when it really went out of control. So this is also a political ploy where people can claim that what they're trying to do is, you know, they're concerned about the greater health of the economy, but really they're more concerned about the interests and needs of the very wealthy that sit at the top of that economy. And one of those tools they can use is manipulating interest rates to ensure that a steady flow of funds, the maximum flow of funds, goes into their pockets. So we really haven't seen a crisis of inflation in quite some time. There's a lot of reasons why this is. There's a lot of financial bubbles that have been created. We have a lot of ways of incentivizing and coercing foreign companies and foreign governments to invest in the U.S. to bring their capital here, which allows us to inflate dollar values. So there's a lot of variables that go into it. But, you know, I can promise you this Trump-appointed chairman is not deeply concerned about working people. He's concerned about making sure that the banking industry and others are feel comfortable with the decisions he's making.
And Daniel, when the Fed raises interest rates, what practical effect does that have on the average consumer? Does it have an effect? Or are we talking about eventual increases in, let's say, mortgage rates or credit card rates or car loan rates, anything like that? Or is this more macro?
So it's both. But for your average consumer, you know, probably most of the people that are listening to this broadcast, it will increase their interest rates. It will make money more expensive. So if you have a variable interest rate, which is in a lot of different loans, credit cards are almost always variable interest rates. A lot of home equity products are variable interest rates. You'll simply see it go up. You will simply be paying more for the products that you're using into servicing the debt that you have. So you will see increase in price and cost. That will be the most dramatic thing. It has macro effects because, of course, that helps banks make more money as the higher interest rates that people are paying on loans, a good portion of that goes into their pockets. So that's positive for them. So, yeah, it's essentially a transfer of wealth from one to the other.
In the 70s, when inflation was high, really high, and interest rates were really high as a consequence, and finally, Paul Volcker, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve at that time, crashed the economy basically to get rid of the inflation by, I believe, imposing such high interest rates that all so much economic activity crashed, massive layoffs. I mean, millions of people lost their jobs. It was a very severe economic recession. We talk about the Great Recession that started in 2007, 2008, but 1979 to 1983 was a very difficult period for working people. But the effect was it did sort of end the period of hyperinflation. And one of the things that some social reformers and social activists and economic social justice people were making the point of is that high inflation was also really detested by the biggest banks, because if you take out loans from the banks at say $100 and the inflation is 15%, that means the value of money has gone down by 15%. It means it's easier to pay back that $100 of original loan money. The banks actually take the loss on inflation. And that as a consequence, it was really the program of the big bankers to get rid of the inflation just for that reason alone. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. But it's more than just that. So banks do benefit, or I should say are hurt by inflation, because you don't have to essentially pay as much back on loans in the future. But banks also hate inflation because those really high interest rates that you talk about, which are usually created in response to inflation as a way to try to pull it back and try to stop it, make it harder for banks to speculate. So when credit is very cheap, when the interest rates are very low, banks can take out huge loans. And what they can do with those loans is they can speculate in various investments, like on the stock market. Well, if let's say the interest rate to take out a loan is 1%, but you can make 10% in the stock market, well, then you have a difference of 9%. You're doing quite well. And you can imagine that the lower the interest rate is to take out that loan, if it's, say, 0.5% or 0.25%, the lower it goes, the more you can profit. That's what we've seen in the last decade with these skyrocketing equity prices in the stock market, is banks have this practically free, extremely cheap credit. They're borrowing billions of it, pumping it into these investments, and the prices are going up and up and up, and everybody's making money.
And that's the essence of what quantitative easing was. Just explain, again, for the lay audience, how that worked and how the quantitative easing mechanism provided that means by which the government allowed the banks basically to get free money.
So we would know the quantitative easing is the technical term for the big bank bailout. I think most people have heard about that. Quantitative easing simply means a couple of things. It was this radical economic policy that had before never been put into place. What it did was it bought all the toxic loans that the banks had taken out, loans that will never be repaid, that people could never afford. It bought them back. The government gave them money in exchange for them because no one else would buy them because they're essentially worthless. And then on top of that, what the government did is lower interest rates to historically practically near zero amounts, meaning that the banks could borrow for free. So they gave them a ton of money for worthless assets, and then they gave them really low interest rates so they could make very cheap loans. So what did the banks do? Well, they didn't, you know, loan out money to factories or anything like that, or loan out money to jobs. They took all that cash and they put it into the stock market, in the derivatives market. And you saw this huge inflation in prices. They made money, right, hand over fist, because the prices went up so insanely. But there was no downstream effect where your average working person then somehow benefited from that run up in prices.
Daniel, let's turn to some of the other big headlines and the big stories on the economic front for this week. Let's talk about the Comcast story.
Absolutely. So what we're seeing right now is a struggle between Fox, owned by Rupert Murdoch, and Comcast over a cable company called Sky. And this company services large portions of Europe, Italy, the UK, I believe France as well. And right now they're in the middle of a fight. Initially, Fox, it looked like, was going to buy the company outright and gain total control over it. I think they owned something like 41% of it. And they wanted to buy the rest of the difference and gain total control. Comcast is moving to block this and is making its own offer, which is substantially more generous. Whether Comcast wins or Rupert Murdoch wins, we lose, because this will be a huge consolidation of media control. It will allow these already very large monopolies to continue to monopolize their markets, and now monopolize their markets globally, because this will impact European consumers far more than it will impact us.
You know, it's amazing to me, Brian and Daniel, how we have now found ourselves in a position where virtually all of our media is corporate owned. In the UK, virtually all British media is corporate owned. And now you have this clash of titans to decide which giant corporation gets more than the other giant corporation. At the same time, independent media is just lost. Daniel, is this happening anywhere else, or is this unique to the US or UK?
And if it is unique, what's its impact on the world?
That's right.
It's certainly the most aggressive in the United States. This isn't to say that it isn't happening in other countries. It most certainly is. But in the United States, I mean, we just saw Ajit Pai being ascended to the FCC chairman role. And it's, you know, very clear he's just a complete puppet and stooge of telecom companies. And yet he is in charge of the regulatory body that's supposed to reel them in and break up their monopolies. So in the U.S., it's the most pronounced. It's a huge part of how our telecom companies have monopolized and now control, you know, nearly all of broadcast, whether internet or cable or other outlets and sources. This is also now starting to go on in Europe as well. It is a process that's well underway. It's not a brand new thing. But in Europe, the regulatory bodies and the public opinion is such that they can't quite monopolize and gouge and gobble up things the way they can in the U.S. The public opinion is still such that it's going to pull it back and rein it in somewhat. So U.K. regulators are very skeptical about these deals and have a lot of questions. But, you know, these big companies have very deep pockets and a lot of power, and they're going to do everything they can to chip it away at it. So I think we'll see a continuation of that monopolization in the UK and in Europe as well. And what this means essentially is that there are a very small, very wealthy group of people that are determining where our sources of information come from and what they contain. And that's huge. That's tremendous because we rely on these for our understanding of the world, what's going on, ourselves. It's an important part of democracy that people be informed and empowered and understand what's going on. And absent, you know, smaller non-corporate owned media sources like Radio Sputnik, it's incredibly hard to get that information. And it's going to become harder and harder as these monopolies grow.
When we look at media consolidation, and this, again, this is what this is all about. As John Kiriakou was making the point, independent voices become fewer and fewer as the media and as social media, as the internet is dominated over, well, excessively by these aggregated media monopolies. That trend is continuing. But every time there's a company merges with another company or is bought out by another company, it also has an impact on workers working in those industries because the so-called redundant jobs, based on the fact that two companies are coming together and there are jobs like jobs in both companies, it also leads to massive layoffs. In other words, concentration of
sure does.
The absence or the negation of democracy or free choice, and also very bad for working people in the industry. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, I can talk about my own experience. When I worked for Wells Fargo, Wachovia started going under and Wells Fargo was able to snap them up at a cheap price. I was laid off because Wachovia had a redundant position in North Carolina, which was a lot cheaper than California. And so myself and about 75, 80 other people in my department in California were all laid off simultaneously. So this is absolutely the case. These conglomerates are able to push down their workforce even more. You know, if you have a set of job skills that's only appropriate for a particular industry, and that industry is controlled by a single entity, practically speaking, it's extremely hard to have any kind of bargaining power. You're going to get paid whatever they want you to get paid because it's not like you can go to another company that's trying to attract you with better prices. And that's what we see here. So it's definitely a huge drain on working people being able to be competitive and get some kind of advantage, and forces them the only other options to try to get reskilled, which is extremely hard to stop in the middle of your career and start over somewhere new. And when you do that, you're almost guaranteed to kind of have to start at the beginning again. And that means your wages will go down comparatively in a new industry. So, yeah, it's a huge detriment to working people.
Murdoch, the Murdoch empire that owns 21st Century Fox. Total assets, $52 billion. They own, of course, Fox International, Fox Network, Fox Business Network, Fox News Channel, Fox Sports Media Group, Fox Television Stations, the National Geographic Channels, National Geographic Partners, Hulu, Fox Studios Australia, 20th Century Fox, Tata Sky, Star TV, LAPD TV, Armstrong. I mean, these are huge, but Comcast is about the same. I mean, So you have, when we're talking about titans going at each other's throat for further consolidation, that's what these people are. I mean, they own almost everything. And nobody, and no small media outlet can possibly stand up against them when it comes to advertising revenues or kind of content or their ability to recruit talent and then sort of diminish or down or, you know, downsize or make bankrupt other companies. Like the British film industry too, you know, it's basically become non-existent as Hollywood and American mega sort of culture corporations have taken over and drowned out all of the traditional other media in big parts of the world. It's, in other words, if you look at, I mean, British industry, British film industry was, it was the premier industry.
It really was.
It's gone.
Major film industry.
There are no movies being made in Britain anymore because Hollywood wanted to make sure that all those studios would be driven out and then replaced by Hollywood-owned companies. Anyway, it's a big picture. Anyway, let's spend one more minute on this. Daniel, we'll go to another subject.
Absolutely. I think one thing we need to point out as well is the incredible power this has. Imagine for a second if a year and a half ago, I told you Russian robots were using Twitter to make Hillary Clinton lose the election. I would have been laughed out of the room. Everyone would have said the chances of Hillary losing the election are, you know, one in a million. And I would have been considered crazy. Now, through the might of these giants, you know, it's a popular opinion in the United States that Russian robots controlling Twitter accounts made Hillary Clinton lose the election. It's bonkers. And yet, if you have that type of incredible monopolized power, you can shift public opinions. It's kind of unimaginable how much control and power they can have, and it only grows as monopolies grow.
Yeah, and that's such a distinction. We make the distinction between the so-called free press, meaning not state-owned media, but really when you have mega corporations whose budget, whose company budget is larger than the gross national product of many, many countries, perhaps most of the countries of the world, they are a power unto themselves. And here you have the FCC, so-called led by Ajit Pai. I mean, he's a stooge of Verizon and the other companies, or that's what I think. Anyway, let's turn in our last 3 minutes to the other subject or one of the other subjects that you submitted that you think are important. AI, artificial intelligence, and automation to begin to kill wages for many U.S. jobs. What's that story?
Yeah, so automation is not a new story. Certainly all of the now called Rust Belt has been hollowed out by both moving jobs overseas, but also by automating a large part of building cars and other commodities. What I think is interesting about this story and worth talking about is the advent of artificial intelligence, which is being ramped up at a dizzying pace. Currently, there is a sizable portion of U.S. workers, call it 20%, 30%, that have jobs that appear, you know, pretty safe from automation. They're not in a factory, and they get paid fairly high wages. These people are typically people for whom kind of our capitalist economic system works, so to speak. Artificial intelligence is coming for these jobs. So I'm talking highly paid professionals like surgeons or engineers or lawyers. They are developing forms of artificial intelligence that can take over large portions of their job. Assuming this is successful, assuming that this is able to be implemented, and certainly it would be, this would be a huge shift in our economy and our society, because these are people for whom, you know, they bought into the dominant narrative that if they work hard and go to school and get good grades, then they're going to get a good job and they're going to do okay. And what I think we'll see is even these, you know, highly paid professionals, take a surgeon, right? We're seeing robotics replacing a lot of surgeons. So people who spent, you know, all this time and money and energy learning this skill will be replaced by a robot that can do this kind of indefinitely, 24 hours a day, and with greater precision than they can. I think this is worth talking about because it's a major shift and a tipping point in our society and economy that this level of automation under the current system is going to produce mass unemployment and mass disillusionment with how our government works. And I think it's something that is really important to be talked about and discussed as we think of a society. How do we organize ourselves so that things like this don't, you know, ruin the lives for millions and millions of workers?
Daniel, we have 1 minute left. I want to ask you about the story with Volkswagen. Go ahead real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one I just had to call up. Volkswagen was sued for all kinds of things. It's EPA scandal. But one thing is it was testing its noxious emissions on monkeys to seeing how long they could live exposed to the fumes from their cars and using, you know, them to experiment on that. And they were upset because they claimed there was a bias in the story because they were being compared to the Nazi party, which tested on other human beings. And they said it wasn't fair that they were being compared to the Nazis and that they objected to this bias, which I think is really kind of ridiculous, given that, as any student of history knows, Volkswagen was a state-owned enterprise and that state was the Nazi state. And so it was literally created by the Nazis. And now they seem to be upset that they're being compared to the Nazis.
Okay, it's a good way to end this story. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Every Tuesday, we bring you the big economic stories of the week with Daniel Sankey. So be sure to check back with Loud and Clear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Recent years have seen an explosion of protest against police brutality and repression. Among activists, journalists, and politicians, the conversation about how to respond and improve or change policing has focused on accountability, diversity, training, and community relations. Unfortunately, these reforms will not produce the results people want. The core of the problem must be addressed, the nature of modern policing itself. Dr. Alex Vitale is the author of The End of Policing, a new book from Verso. He is an associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project there. He has written recent articles on policing in the New York Daily News, The Nation, USA Today, and New Republic, and he serves on the New York State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Dr. Vitale, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I have to say that the title of your book, which I agree with, is going to be a shock for a lot of people. How could it possibly be that we would have an end of policing? People will think automatically, well, how will we be safe? How will our communities be safe? But your thesis is that the function of the police and policing isn't really about keeping us safe or fighting crime or protecting our communities. Talk about what the core thesis of your book is.
Well, the title has a kind of double meaning. Obviously, it's a question about whether or not we really need police to do what they're doing. But as part of that, it also has a kind of ends and means, which is, you know, what is the real purpose of policing? And while it is certainly the case that police wake up in the morning, most of them trying to figure out how to help people, in at least some sense, that the tools they have to do that are not very good, and that when push comes to shove, there are other basic political priorities that really drive what the institution does. And the thesis of the book is that there are much more just and effective ways of producing community safety than relying almost exclusively on people with guns to threaten us. And that policing should be understood as a kind of deeply problematic institution whose history is rooted in regimes of exploitation. And basically, I spend a chapter looking at the historical roots of policing and their ties to colonialism, slavery, and the kind of creation and management of an industrial working class. And policing has always been about managing the consequences of those mechanisms of exploitation much more than it's been about making people safe. And we can see this in some of the very cynical and ineffective things they do, like the war on drugs. We've had a war on drugs for 40 years. Drugs are cheaper, easier to get, and of higher quality than they've ever been. Any high school kid in America can get drugs anytime they want them. So it's hard to make an argument that the millions of people who've been put in prison for drugs by the police has anything to do with public safety.
I want to ask you about the New York City experiment under Rudy Giuliani. So much was made about Giuliani's law and order policies. He cleaned up the city. The train stations weren't full of homeless people. But in fact, New York City's problems were really only masked during those Giuliani years. Why did Giuliani's get tough law and order, law enforcement positions fail?
Yeah, well, that's actually the topic of my previous book called City of Disorder. about the rise of kind of broken windows, quality of life politics in New York City. And really what that's about, it's about the kind of neoliberal restructuring of urban politics, moving away from any kind of great society oriented model towards one of using the police to manage the growing inequality that we see in cities, especially places like New York and San Francisco, where the very rich are getting extremely wealthy, skewing housing markets, polarizing labor markets, and leaving a vast group of people completely out of the formal economy. And what Giuliani showed was not that police could necessarily do anything about serious crime, but that they could manage disorder, squeegee men, homeless people living in the parks, public drug dealing. So policing can address those public disorders, but it did absolutely nothing to reduce the number of homeless people, the availability of drugs. It just changed the public impact of those things. Homelessness went up every year under Giuliani's mayoralty.
Dr. Alex Vitale is our guest. He is the author of a new book, The End of Policing, which is published by Verso Publishers. Dr. Vitale, let's go through, because the United States is such a unique country. I mean, no other like major capitalist country has evolved the way this country evolved. I mean, this is a settler regime that came into existence when people from other countries either came here to settle it or came because they had been kidnapped and enslaved. There was an indigenous population that was ultimately defeated militarily and their lands were taken. But as we go through the evolution of this particular social and economic order, policing evolved through different stages and phases. And it gives it a kind of particular, and I would say maybe very toxic and very violent character in relationship to some of the other major advanced industrial nations. When did modern policing become a thing?
Right. So I think, I always say there's like two parts to this story. There's one part that's like hundreds of years old and is about colonialism and slavery and industrialization. And then there's another part that's actually more recent that's about neoliberalism and the restructuring of the American economy. So let's go back to the older part. You know, liberal scholars will often talk about policing as this sort of professional, uniformed law enforcement body that begins in 1829 with the London Metropolitan Police as this professional, neutral, policing by consent kind of model. But what gets left out of that conversation is the fact that the idea and the experimentation that led to the London Metropolitan Police was done during the English occupation of Ireland, and that the person who was in charge of creating the London Metropolitan Police had previously been in charge of that British occupation, where he was trying to figure out how to put down agrarian movements against British rule. And he develops the Irish Peace Preservation Force as the precursor to what becomes the London Metropolitan Police, who deal not with agricultural outrages, as they were called, but with the machinations of this massive new industrial urban workforce that had to be molded into a docile workforce in the face of horrible exploitation and horrible living conditions, etc. In the U.S., in the North, we take that model, and in the South, we developed our own model out of the management of slave populations. And over the last 200 years, we've had a melding of these models of basically managing populations who are on the losing end of exploitative economic systems. And you're absolutely right that American policing, I think, is particularly militaristic, toxic, aggressive, and violent because of our twin legacy of settler colonialism, the mass extermination of the indigenous population, and slavery, because you can't have those systems of exploitation without a massive mobilization of violence supported by the state. Policing today doesn't have that same degree of overt violence, and it's focused more on managing those populations that have been left out of the economy. the growing underclass of homeless folks, unemployed young people, folks who get involved in black market activity. And that's really the focus of day-to-day policing. It's not catching armed robbers and homicidal maniacs. It's the constant harassment, broken windows, theory-oriented policing of these populations who've been left out.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I mean, there's the kind of cliche refrain, but really common sense proposition that people say to each other in the community all the time. You can never find a cop when you need one, when there's actually a crime going on or violence or danger. But afterwards and all the time, they're there. They're sort of occupying. They're constantly present. You have a chapter in your book called The Limits of Police Reform. And I think it's important that, and I want, I mean, John and I are encouraging people to read your book because this is perhaps one of the most talked about topics in America, how to do something about police violence and the epidemic of police killing and all of the attendant problems that go around with it. And, you know, as a consequence, there's a discussion, but it's a pretty limited discussion about what's possible. Should police wear body cameras or not? And then who gets access to the body cameras? And should there be civilian control over police departments? And, you know, all of these reforms have many, many limitations. In your chapter in the limits of reform, of limits of police reform on page 25, the subtitle is Disarm the Police. And the first sentence or two I'm going to read and then have you comment. Since 1900, the police in Great Britain have killed a total of 50 people. In March 2016 alone, U.S. police killed more than 100 people. Yes, there are more people and more guns in the United States, but the scale of police killings goes far beyond these differences. Help us understand, why do we live in with this phenomena as almost an accepted reality?
Yeah, well, I think we have to look at these roots, right, that we were just talking about what the historical function of police has been. You think about the first state police force in the United States, the Pennsylvania State Police, who were created in 1905, basically with the purpose of putting down strikes. They were unable, the mine owners, the factory owners, were unable to put these strikes down using either private security guards or local police. So they used their political power to get the Pennsylvania state government to create a state police force modeled after the U.S. occupation of the Philippines following the Spanish-American Civil War. They needed a force that could use violence to put down strikes. And that's what they did. The miners even started calling them the American or the Pennsylvania Cossacks. So when we create policing to manage people who are angry about their exploitation, then there's going to be violence in the mix. And I think that as much as we want to talk about how to demilitarize the police, find ways to reduce the reliance on guns of the police, ultimately, we're going to have to manage the super exploitation of the American economy differently so that violence isn't built into the system.
We've spoken several times on this program about Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, which is where the whole concept of solitary confinement originated. You argue that policing is historical. Where did we go wrong? We know where we went wrong on incarceration, but where did we go wrong on policing? And is it too late to correct those wrongs?
So I think, you know, we've had this really amazing explosion of research on the carceral state and mass incarceration. So important, bringing issues of racial justice to the fore. But what has been left out of a lot of that conversation is the central role that the police play. And part of that is to keep in mind that the problems of policing should never be reduced to an egregious killing or beating that's captured on videotape. That's always just the tip of an iceberg of over-policing, racialized social control that often doesn't even result in arrest or incarceration, but takes the form of racialized stop and frisk practices, harassing young people from hanging out on the street corner. And it's that everyday micromanagement of poor communities and communities of color that characterizes this explosion of invasive and aggressive policing. So if we want to do something about the racializing character of the state in the United States, we cannot focus solely on the question of prisons. We have to get at this issue of policing. And for me, the issue comes down to basically a choice that the state has to make. Are they going to criminalize people who are being exploited or left out of the economy, or are they going to find ways to build people up and bring them into the economy in meaningful ways? And right now, politicians of both parties have chosen primarily a strategy of criminalization. And this has been true for a long time. They are using crime and race as a cynical strategy for winning over votes. And as long as that politics remains dominant in both parties, we're not going to have racial justice, and we're going to have heavy-handed, aggressive policing and mass incarceration. So we have to understand these problems as fundamentally political. There are no technocratic fixes to this. Body cameras, community policing are not going to solve these problems. We've got to invest in communities and get rid of things like the war on drugs instead.
That's the voice of Dr. Alex Vitale. He's the author of a new book, The End of Policing, published by Verso Books. Dr. Vitale, since you mentioned politicians and the cynical use and the opportunist use of law and order proclamations for their own narrow electoral gains, but not really to solve social problems or to deal with the problem, again, I want to read a sentence or a paragraph, in fact, from your book, The End of Policing. This is in the chapter entitled The School to Prison Pipeline. I'll read a few sentences. Politicians in the 1990s had already embraced the idea that criminality was a deeply embedded moral failing that was largely impervious to reform. The only appropriate response, they argued, was a long-term incarceration as seen in the rise of the three strikes laws and other mandatory minimum sentencing schemes. President Bill Clinton was more than happy to oblige. In 1994, he introduced the Gun-Free Schools Act, which ushered in, quote, zero tolerance, close quote, school discipline policies. Following that lead, legislators and school administrators embraced a raft of harsh disciplinary codes, placing surveillance systems, metal detectors, and huge numbers of police in schools. These policies have led to the growing criminalization of young people despite falling crime rates. Now, I think that's an extremely important point.
Yeah,
because,
it sure is.
Because we're talking about what happened in Florida and the liberal sort of wing or the centrist wing or the Democratic Party are arguing that more harsh gun control legislation like these introduced in the 1990s will keep the country safe. But what the statistics actually reveal, Dr. Vitale, is, as far as I can see from your book, is that it's not necessarily going to stop violence in schools, but it will lead a lot more young people, and particularly young people in black and brown, working class and poor communities, to go straight to prison. Is that how you see it?
Yes, that is how I see it. Is that, and we have to understand this right in a larger context about what's happening in education, what's happening in schools, right? It's not a coincidence that the rise of school police is linked to the rise of charter schools, high stakes testing, and disinvestment in public education. They are managing school failure by giving it to the cops. And this is what's happening in terms of homelessness, mental health, drug problems, et cetera. We're pulling out the basic need for services and replacing it with social control mechanisms. And absolutely, arming police or teachers is a horrible idea. When we put guns into circulation in a population, we're going to have more accidental shootings, we're going to have more suicides, and there's no evidence at all that it's going to make anyone any safer. There were armed police at Columbine. There were armed police at that school in Florida. and it made no difference at all. So this is really about the mobilization of fear to sell more guns. And the fact that the Democrats are falling into this shows how committed they are to the fundamental politics of privatizing public education and disinvestment in communities that need that education funding. And it's really a horrible development. It shows how far we have to go in this struggle.
Dr. Vitale, you argue in the book that true safety demands directing resources away from police and prisons and toward economic development, education, and drug treatment. Do you see that happening anywhere in the United States? Is there any, even if it's just a local police district, that's experimenting with these more progressive ideas and showing some success?
Yeah, I think people should look at the Ithaca plan, named for Ithaca, New York, which is where Cornell University is based. They have a mayor there who, you know, is seeing the problem of drugs in his community and understands the total futility of relying on police as your strategy for dealing with it. So he brought in medical experts, people from harm reduction, people who've been drug involved, and they spent a year or so meeting, having town hall meetings, doing focus groups with constituency organizations, with the public, and developed a comprehensive plan for dealing with the drug problems in Ithaca. And guess what? More police is not on the plan. Drug treatment on demand, crisis centers, safe injection facilities, diversion programs, summer jobs for young people, better employment for those members of the communities that have been left out of the formal economy. That's what the plan calls for, not more police. And that is the direction that we need to be going in. So yes, there are examples. Another would be looking at Minneapolis that's been trying to develop community-based anti-violence efforts instead of gang suppression policing, which we know doesn't work. So there are plenty of examples out there. The Center for Popular Democracy has been writing about these examples around the country. So these are the kinds of struggles that, in my mind, ultimately are what police reform looks like.
Dr. Alex Vitale is our guest. He's the author of a new book, The End of Policing, from Verso Books. Let's go to a couple of other areas that are obviously in the news regarding policing and their efficacy. Certainly, they're gaining a lot of headlines. One is has to do with the suppression of gangs or the policing of gangs. And I think probably in the public eye, there's a strong sense that a great deal of the violence that people are experiencing or criminality that people are experiencing is gang driven. On the other hand, the way the anti-gang laws are written and the way the policing is conducted, whole communities are actually under sort of a guilt by association system, whereby if you have a friend who happens to be a gang member or your neighbor, a family member, you too can be targeted and are targeted. And so especially like in Latino communities, we see this phenomenon having a profound impact in many, many different kinds of ways. You have a chapter in your book called Gang Suppression, Chapter 8 of The End of Policing. Talk about what the situation is right now and what you are suggesting.
Yeah, so this is actually the main work that I'm doing right now. I have a research center here, the Policing and Social Justice Project, and on our website is information about this. But we've had these huge raids here in New York City where 75, 85, 100, 120 people are rounded up and charged with conspiracy. They don't have any connection to violence directly. They're not even being accused of violent acts, but they're being charged with conspiracy to commit murder and things like that. They're held without bail, given these horrible plea deals, terrible pressure placed on them and their families. And in the end, they maybe get time served for marijuana possession when everything ultimately shakes out. So there is a lot of criminalization of young people that is done under the banner of gangs. And really, there's a profound confusion about what they even mean by gangs. Are they talking about five people who have a drug ring, who are using violence in the perpetuation of organized drug selling? Or are they talking about kids that walk to school together and sometimes get into fights with kids in the next housing project over? The police just conflate all that. Anytime a young person uses violence against another young person, that's gang violence. No matter, though, what type of activity we're talking about, heavy-handed policing is not an effective strategy for dealing with it. We've learned a lot about how to deal with low-level youth violence, this kind of tit-for-tat, the beefs that happen, the cure violence model, the use of community-based violence interrupters has been shown to work when properly implemented. And if the problem is about organized drug gangs, this sort, we need to look at drug decriminalization, drug legalization regimes, community investment. Putting those people in the criminal justice system drives mass incarceration, destroys the lives of those young people, and often their families and communities as well. The fact that Trump now is using this as like a bright line issue for him should just alert to people how caustic and illegitimate all this gang talking is.
You write throughout the book about the war on drugs, the failure of the so-called war on drugs, but you also write about the war on terror. Tell us how that's changed policing.
Yeah, well, this is another big expansion of local policing and national policing is the war on terror. Here in New York, we found out that they basically created a mini CIA within the New York City Police Department.
Headed by a former senior CIA officer, as a matter of fact.
That's correct. So on the one hand, they have now a warehouse full of people who are reading newspapers and blogs and chat rooms all around the world doing baseline foreign intelligence gathering. And on the other hand, they had this demographics unit that was going around spying on Muslim and Arab communities in bookstores, in mosques, in community centers, in people's homes, on college campuses, all without any kind of public oversight or approval, based completely on profiling. They had no suspicion of individualized wrongdoing. They never found a single criminal act engaging in this broad spying. So this is also what happens is that they set up these fusion centers and joint terrorism task forces. But since they don't really have any real terrorism problems to deal with for the most part, they either A, invent them through entrapment schemes where they find vulnerable people, people with developmental disabilities, and talk them into incriminating themselves, or they turn their attention towards lawful protest activity. So whenever we get documents from these fusion centers and joint terrorism task force, it turns out they're spying on lawful, peaceful, nonviolent protest movements like the Occupy movement, like labeling Black Lives Matter, Black identity extremists, and these sorts of things. So all of this is a form of political policing, which has always been at the center of policing and is one of the most dangerous things they do because they cloak it in secrecy, they operate outside the law, and they use it to try to destroy social movements.
All right, we're going to leave it there. I myself have looked at the FOIA documents received by the D.C.-based Partnership for Civil Justice Fund on Occupy, for instance, thousands of pages of documents. The fusion centers and the FBI and all of them were using all of their anti-terrorism authority and anti-terrorism funding to do this micromanaged surveillance on every little thing that took place in the Occupy movement, even though they themselves proclaimed it to be a completely or almost completely peaceful protest movement. I mean, it shows such an abuse of the war on terror banner. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined by Dr. Alex Vitale, the author of The End of Policing. We encourage you to get that book. It's published by Verso. That's V-E-R-S-O. He is an associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Program at the college. He has written recent articles on policing in the New York Daily News, The Nation, USA Today, and New Republic. And he serves on the New York State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.